to the 9th episode of Let's Talk Shakespeare, a podcast brought to you from Stratford-upon-Avon by the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. I'm Jennifer Reid, and today we're going all the way to the end of Shakespeare's life and asking the question, how did Shakespeare die? Well, we know he did, and that he is buried in the chancel of Holy Trinity Church here in Stratford-upon-Avon. And when we think about how Shakespeare died, there's one story, one myth that prevails over all others that you will hear repeatedly referred to throughout this podcast by pretty much all the speakers. So my first clip is from Ben Crystal to kick off the conversation about how Shakespeare died.
Slowly, by all apparent evidence, we don't know. We know that towards the end of his career, his writing took a bit of a wobble in terms of he knocked it out of the park with a series of terrific plays, Macbeth, Antony and Cleopatra, Coriolanus, King Lear, a little bit of a dip, the Timon of Athens and so, Cymbeline you could argue, some would even say Pericles, as he begins to collaborate again with younger writers. Then we have a couple of swan songs with The Tempest, a reworking of a different sort of version of Two Gentlemen of Verona with Two Noble Kinsmen, and then the very odd piece to end with Henry VIII. And you get the impression of a man sort of just petering out. He was very old, of course, by the time he died. 52 was a grand old age from the average life expectancy of Elizabethans were in the early 30s. There's all sorts of apocryphal tales about how he died from drinking too much or whatever, but we know that he died at home, that he went back to Stratford, that he had time to write his will. Slipped away.
So a bit of scene setting there from Ben. That we don't know what Shakespeare died of is quite frustrating, but the fact is we know very little about what killed people specifically in those days due to the lack of medical knowledge. However, this is made even more frustrating by the fact that Shakespeare's son-in-law was John Hall, the renowned physician whose notes were published after his death and record in detail the treatment of his patients. Hall does mention the treatment of his own wife, Shakespeare's daughter Susanna, but sadly makes no reference to treating Shakespeare or how he failed to save his famous father-in-law's life. So next up we have Liz Dollymore, who is the manager of outreach and primary learning at the SBT. And she can talk about some of the things that may have killed Shakespeare.
Nobody knows how Shakespeare died. There are as many theories as there are theorists as to how Shakespeare died. Again, there's an apocryphal story that's grown up around that about how his friends from London came and visited him in Stratford and they got into a bit of hard drinking and chatting and he passed away the next day. However, I mean, he wasn't an old man, even by the standards of the time. Really, he'd have been more likely to have a hangover than die. So there's several things that aren't quite straight somehow about that story. When we think about the likely killers of people in that time period, one of the most often suggested would be typhus fever, typhoid fever, because it was supposedly particularly common if you lived near a stream, and there was indeed a stream that ran along the bottom of the kind of new place property. So that's a possible one, but really nobody knows. I mean, death was recorded, but not reasons for death. I guess a lot of the time they didn't know why you died, so what could have been recorded? Sometimes they did record it if people died of the plague, because they tried to track plague deaths so they could be aware of whether or not it was spreading. So it's unlikely that he died of the plague, but apart from that.
And so, let's talk about that apocryphal drinking bout. This story first appears after Shakespeare's death, but it has prevailed, and it's a wonderfully romantic idea. Our famous writer, full of beer, sleeping in the open air in the English countryside under an oak tree. But the likelihood of it? Next up is Professor Stanley Wells to give us a bit more detail about this story and the likelihood of it being true.
How did Shakespeare die? Well, we don't know for certain. There are one or two rumours about it. There is a story told by a vicar in the middle of the 17th century, quite a long time after Shakespeare died, about 50 years after Shakespeare died, who said that Shakespeare died after a drinking bout with Ben Jonson and Michael Drayton. Those both writers, Ben Jonson, a writer who was based in London, a writer who was certainly both a friend and a rival of Shakespeare's. He was a very strong character, was Ben Jonson, a man of great prejudices. He wrote the great tribute to Shakespeare, which is printed in the First Folio, the first serious appreciation of Shakespeare, in which he talks about him as being not of an age, not of a single age, but for all time. So he was very admiring of Shakespeare. It's not impossible that he came up to Stratford to see Shakespeare. Drayton was a frequent visitor. Drayton was a poet and playwright who spent much time at Clifford Chambers, only a mile away from Stratford. So there could be truth in that story that they drank too much and got an infection after it for some reason. It's true that for the last 3 years of his life, he doesn't seem to be writing any plays. So it does look as if he felt played out in some way or other. Whether he was actually ill or just tired, he was in his mid-40s, not old, of course, but at the same time, fairly old for the time, you might say. Some people did live to be very old in Shakespeare's time, but to die in your mid-40s was not to die particularly young. He presumably died in Stratford, in New Place. We have no records of that. He did make his will, however, in the last few months of his life, and it's not uncommon, particularly in that period, for people to delay making their wills until they know that they're likely to die before long. So that may be some indication that he knew he was dying. Sadly, it's not a very personal will. It doesn't tell us anything about his artistic achievements. He doesn't leave books or manuscripts or papers or anything like that. We only have the will itself, the draft of the will, in fact. We don't have the inventory that would have accompanied it, must have accompanied it. That is lost, like so many other documents of the period. It's quite possible that inventory mentioned the books and the papers, which were probably which must have been in New Place. And the coat of arms, for example. His father was awarded a coat of arms in 1597, which passed on to Shakespeare, which made him officially a gentleman, and that would have been something to display and become a family heirloom. Who knows, they may still survive somewhere. We keep on hoping that sometime, somewhere, somebody may be able to trace the family, some of these family possessions. Something like a silver bowl could survive somewhere. It might have been inscribed. On the other hand, it might have been melted down into for sale for the sake of the precious metal of it, of which it was made. He had a sword. The sword, I suspect, was part of his livery. It would be part of his official garment when he was serving the king. He left his sword to a young friend, a 27-year-old man, friend of the Coombe family, with whom we have other records of Shakespeare's association. I write about that family in our book, Shakespeare's Circle. The sword would normally, one is supposed, have gone to his son, but his son, sadly, Hamnet, died when he was only 11 years old. Shakespeare left his sword out of his family, presumably had a fondness for this young man who may well have played with Shakespeare's son when he was a boy.
Stanley mentioned there Shakespeare's will, and we've talked about the will in a lot of previous episodes. In episode 2, in relation to Anne Hathaway in the second best bed, in reference to where he lived, and in episode 8 about Shakespeare's worth. But I'm just going to play the short clip from Paul Edmondson, and Paul's the head of research and knowledge at the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, and this is just a little recap and summary of Shakespeare's will.
The will survives only in draft, and the will is a complicated document. It was certainly the version that survives, the latest draft, certainly shows signs of revision, that he seems to have started writing it much earlier than we've supposed, but then revises it on the 25th of March 1616, which suggests he knew he was dying then, and of course he dies about a month later. He seems to have revised the will because of his daughter's unfortunate marriage, although probably it was fortunate for her, it seems to have been a very happy marriage, with Thomas Quiney. There was some social scandal attached to Quiney himself. He'd got with child an already married woman, Margaret Wheeler, who had his baby, and both she and the baby died in childbirth. And then, you know, this just before he marries Judith Quiney, and of course it all transpires just after they got married. So Shakespeare certainly seems to have revised what he would have left to Judith had she married a different man.
Now, there have been a lot of references in this podcast to Shakespeare's age when he died and life expectancy at the time. And a few of these references have contradicted each other. And that's because there are a few problems with using the term life expectancy, and these numbers can be really skewed. So my next speaker, and in fact the rest of my clips for this episode, is from Tara Hanling, who lectures in early modern history at the University of Birmingham. And my first clip from Tara, in this one she clarifies a bit about life expectancy and about Shakespeare's age when he died.
Life expectancy is a difficult question. It varies according to social status. But certainly for people with means, if you lived beyond a certain age, especially for women that would be around your childbearing age, then that the expectation was you could go on and live until actually well into your 70s and 80s. There isn't, you know, there's no sort of age where you reach and that's it, you know. You've reached your life expectancy age at 60. No, that's it. In fact, people did live very long and full lives. But obviously, there's an awful lot of sickness, illness, disease around that could affect you at any age. And we can assume that Shakespeare picked up some kind of infection, whether it was from a drinking bout, I don't know. Yeah, so obviously that, and again, it's sort of socially specific, but obviously you've got a lot of children dying, and children are more susceptible to the disease that's around. So that can skew the figures. But you have also got a rise in population over Shakespeare's lifetime. So actually people are becoming more robust and more children are surviving. And there's still an awful lot of death and mortality around, and periodic outbreaks of the plague, you know, obviously takes out huge numbers of the population. But overall, the demographic is actually that there are more people around, population explosion, living longer. So is Shakespeare typical? Not really. But, you know, what's typical? You've got the whole spectrum.
Well, that clears that up a bit. Now, what we're going to look at with Tara for the rest of this podcast is not what Shakespeare died of and what killed him, but what his death would have been like. Morbid, I know, but bear with her because it's not as gruesome as it sounds.
So people like to think about how Shakespeare died. We know a fair amount about Shakespeare's death, unlike other parts of his life. And there are lovely stories about how he got drunk and he, you know, then contracted some kind of fever or flu because he was drinking, too heavy a drinking bout. It's all great. It's all great speculation, but we just don't know. And actually, you've got to give a little bit of credit to some of these stories because, you know, folk tales sometimes can survive, you know, for longer and in more with grains of truth to them than some other recorded forms of history. But really and honestly, we don't know, so we can only speculate, and they're lovely stories. But what I'm interested in is what we can reconstruct about Shakespeare's deathbed based on contemporary advice literature, because there was a huge emphasis on making a good death in this period, and that had two aspects to it. One of it was concerned with taking care of worldly affairs, and the other was taking care of spiritual affairs. So a good death involved, first of all, making a will, making sure that you'd secured your material inheritance and that was all clean and tidy and sorted out. The other was to do with making sure that you were sufficiently spiritually prepared to meet your maker. Because in the early modern period, there was a sort of popular culture surrounding the idea of living to die and dying to live. And this tradition is known as the memento mori tradition, which just literally means, it's a Latin phrase that just means remember you must die. And that particular inscription, live to die, is found on lots of objects and surfaces in the period. So you would have seen this inscription, memento mori, or live to die, everywhere you went. You know, it's there in a huge amount of printed material, both visual and textual. And it's there in things like objects, so spoons with live to die written on it. And this was very much an embedded part of the visual and sort of popular culture of Shakespeare's lifetime. So this would have been something Shakespeare would have absorbed. And he would have known that the expectation was that he should meditate on death, meditate on his own state of spiritual preparedness, and this was not something that something we kind of associate with the Gothic tradition and see it as sort of dark and morbid, but actually this was something that for a Protestant Christian society would have actually been about hope in an expectation for, you know, the eternal life with God and Christ, and this would have been eternal bliss. So the idea of live to die, but die to live, is actually a very positive message, and this is what people were encouraged to meditate on. So as somebody got ill, there was obviously even more emphasis on this sort of tradition and that sort of sense of, are you spiritually prepared to meet your maker, to enter into the eternal life? And we can assume that as well as absorbing this sort of tradition throughout his life on his own sickbed and his own deathbed approach, there would have been certain manoeuvrings in order to make sure that this met the requirements of a good death. And the main requirement of a good death in material terms would be that you're in your bed, and that you are, you know, you're there, you're prepared, you've made your will, you've got your family around you, and you've sorted out your soul, you're in a good place, ready to die. So that kind of scenario, given Shakespeare's status, given his literacy, it doesn't even do it justice, but his enormous understanding of the culture of the time and the printed culture of the time and the expectations of the time, we can assume that Shakespeare would have absorbed a lot of this. Whether he then observed all of these aspects of a good death, he almost certainly would have wanted to observe the sort of formal conventional aspects that are linked to status. So, as I say, when it comes to how did Shakespeare die, the question, we can imagine him in his bed at New Place, having made his will, which we have, and we know that he did, he sorted that out, having kind of considered the future of his family, he then would have had to turn his attentions to his own spiritual affairs, and presumably reflected on his life and his achievements and his moral virtues.
Now, I find this sort of thing fascinating, the parts of Tudor life that are so different from our lives today, but yet so the same. And we have some books in the collections here at the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust that are exactly those guidebooks that Tara referred to there, in which they give advice on how to have a good death, and others also give advice on how to mourn and grieve appropriately. And it's really easy to imagine that because death was all around them and that child mortality was much higher, that they dealt with death in a much more removed way than we do today, and that they didn't grieve as deeply. But these sorts of books really show that the exact opposite was true, in fact. So we can imagine what Shakespeare's deathbed was like, but what was his funeral like?
Shakespeare didn't make any specific instructions for his funeral, which some people did of gentry status. They would specify the nature of the funeral. They wanted gifts to be made at the funeral. The people that were most worried about the nature of the funeral were either very elite in status, so they had certain expectations surrounding the sort of state and pomp and ceremony of their funeral, or they were of a particular religious persuasion and they wanted their funeral to reflect that. So people that were very, very strictly Protestant would specify that they didn't want any pomp and circumstance around their funeral. They wanted it to be very plain so that they didn't become a kind of form of idol. Shakespeare didn't mention any of that. He just passes over that. So we can assume that he wasn't elite, which we know, and he didn't have any particular investment in a particular kind of funeral to show his religious affiliation. He does make bequests in his will to certain friends in London and in Stratford of mourning rings, rings for remembrance. And those rings were sometimes given out at the funeral. Sometimes, as in Shakespeare's will, it's an amount of money to be spent on a ring. So it's unclear whether that happens before or after the funeral, but that's tied up with funeral arrangements. If so, then we can expect a fairly conventional funeral for somebody of Shakespeare's status. Not too much pomp, not too much ceremony, but of the right sort of character for someone of, obviously, by this time he dies in 1616, Shakespeare's very much an established member of the community and a citizen of Stratford, and he would have had a funeral of appropriate fitting status. But in terms of detail, nothing except the mourning rings.
Now, if you go to Holy Trinity Church today, you'll see a fantastic monument to Shakespeare that was erected shortly after he died. This is one of the images of Shakespeare that is reckoned to be likely to be lifelike, because it was put up by people who knew him and knew the monument to be a likeness of him. My final clip is again from Tara to talk about this monument and the tradition of memorial monuments in churches.
So the monument that we have, the memorial to Shakespeare, goes up at some time after his death, so mysteriously appears So that's not unusual in that, obviously, unless somebody has the memorial put up in their own lifetime, which some individuals chose to do, and they would have a sort of weird situation where they'd be in church on a Sunday with their sort of funeral effigy next to them. You know, and sometimes they could live for many, many years after the funeral effigy goes up. But again, that's part of the process of reflecting on your own death and your own spiritual state, and having an effigy there of yourself is actually part of that, and perfectly appropriate behaviour, not strange. But for probably two-thirds of the population, monuments were put up by their executors or heirs after they died. So it's unknown whether it's Anne or Susanna and John Shakespeare that have the funeral monument put up in Holy Trinity. It's likely that they would have been responsible for it, although there is also the suggestion that it was put up by friends in London, colleagues in London, as part of the drive towards commemorating Shakespeare through his works embodied by the folio. So it could have been that the monument was put up at the same time as the folio, although it's slightly odd that such emphasis would have been put on Shakespeare in Stratford at that point by those interested in celebrating his achievements in London as a writer. So it's not quite certain who put the monument up originally. What's likely, though, is that the monument's been fiddled with over the time in between it was put up and now, to make it look more in keeping with the kind of man and genius that Shakespeare was. For example, it's not clear from the earliest drawings of the monument whether he was originally holding a quill. So it's just one of those brilliant mysteries surrounding the sort of legacy of Shakespeare and the material traces of his biography that keep us guessing. It would have been weird because people in Stratford wouldn't have known Shakespeare as a writer. And other similar monuments of people of Shakespeare standing, they just have their hands there. Mm-hmm. They're holding a cushion, effectively, sort of posed. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's probably one of the additions that came along later. But, you know, it's been repainted multiple times. You know, it's an odd thing. It's not... It's great because it's one of the few things we have that's roughly of the right date and things like that's what he looked like, but it's been so fiddled with. It's a conventional expression of monuments, you know, because at that point the effigy is supposed to represent the soul in heaven. They're supposed to look slightly removed and otherworldly. You know, it's not meant to look like a portrait as in life. So it's sort of that starry quality, you know, there but not there, is absolutely conventional and what you would expect. He's not in a pose that you find on some monuments where he's sort of leaning on one hand, which is sort of known as the melancholy pose, but also reflects the fact that the person has departed and is no longer in this realm, no longer in this world. They're represented as if, you know, being thoughtful in heaven. But he is represented in a kind of conventional pose associated with orators, so preachers and professional people, which is just the head and shoulders, you know, the bust, and the sort of hands on a cushion, looking like he might sort of say something. But again, there are plenty of examples of very similar monuments for people of similar sort of standing. Different careers maybe, but similar sort of social standing, yeah. A lot of churchmen are represented in that sort of
way.
Oh, really? Yeah. So churchmen are another example of somebody that's sort of made... They're of a certain status, but they're not elite, and they don't merit having a huge monument and a full-body monument, in the same way that it wasn't appropriate to depict somebody of middling status full-body in a portrait. It wasn't really appropriate to depict a full-body in a monument either. So it's very much in keeping with his status at his death.
Well, that's us for today's podcast. Thanks for joining us, and thank you to all the people who spoke to me for this podcast. That's Ben, Liz, Tara, Stanley and Paul. A huge thanks to the Friends of the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, without whom this podcast would not be possible. If you want to find out more, please head over to our blog findingshakespeare.co.uk, where you'll find the accompanying blog post for this episode. It's got some nice pictures and some links to some further information on Shakespeare's death. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at ShakespeareBT or use the hashtag TalkShakespeare. And do join us next week for the final podcast in this series, where we'll be looking at how Shakespeare got so popular.